Hi, I'm Catherine Mengu Ward. This is The Reason Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes and rate and review us. I'm filling in for Nick Gillespie today, who is in Australia chasing down the dingo that ate his baby. I am joined by Peter Suderman, Reason's features editor. Say hi to the nice people, Peter.
Hi, nice people.
And Stephanie Slade, Reason Magazine's managing editor.
How's it going?
Matt is on an airplane to Los Angeles. Nick, honestly, I don't know where he is. Pretty sure Australia, could be New Zealand. It's unclear. We are going to talk about the news this week, starting with the Pope. Stephanie, Slade, tell us what the Pope has done to libertarians.
Yeah, well, apparently on Friday, he gave a speech to the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences in which he came out swinging against libertarianism. Now, I want to say first off that I use the word apparently, and that's because A, there doesn't seem to be text of this speech anywhere, and B, what we know about it was reported primarily initially by Breitbart. So we're going off of a Breitbart write-up right now. So take that, you know, into consideration. But from what we know, it sounds like he came out saying that the radical philosophy of individualism that libertarians hold on to is basically the root of all evil. And so I responded to that on the Reason blog on Friday night. Because I think it's important to push back and to make clear. Now, I'm of course Reason's resident Roman Catholic. The Pope is the leader of my faith, but even within Catholicism, it's definitely not the case that popes are considered to be infallible every time they open their mouths. So I thought it was important in this case to say, hold up a minute, let's talk a little bit about what it is that he is saying right now.
So it's kind of a compliment to libertarianism, though. Like, my first reaction was like, isn't it great that the Pope woke up this morning and was like, it's time to smack down libertarians? Is that an unfair characterization?
I mean, I guess as a Catholic, it's less of a great thing for me, from my perspective.
I feel sad, actually, that Nick isn't here to say right now, like, more evidence of the libertarian moment. But it feels a little bit that way. Peter, are you going to follow the Pope and agree that, in fact, the selfishness inherent in libertarianism is ruining society?
Surprisingly, I'm going to disagree. And I mean, look, this is a constant tension, not just in Catholic thought, but in all sort of religious thinking, you know, sort of between the kind of communitarian worldview and a somewhat more sort of incentive-based worldview. And there is a long history of religious teaching that basically suggests that if you are kind of concerned about individuals and you're concerned about sort of social incentives for doing good or helping people, then that's a bad way to set up society, because in fact people should be concerned about doing good for others rather than doing good for themselves. And you know, the idea is basically that people shouldn't do that. Doing good for yourself never leads to good for others. That it's basically a zero sum game. There is also a long history of kind of individualistic thought in religion, and there's, like I said, there's a lot of tension there. This is not in some ways entirely new. I think this Pope is probably a little more prone to the, you know, sort of, he sides a little more with the kind of communitarians, maybe a lot more.
I feel like you just soft-pedaled that a little bit. Slade, is it not fair to say the current Pope is a goddamn socialist?
I mean, that might be going a little too far, but only a little bit. I can read a few of the things that he's reported to have said. Things like, there are grave risks associated with the invasion of the positions of libertarian individualism at a high strata of culture and in our universities, which...
Right. So it's like paging Robbie Suave. Apparently, our universities have been taken over by libertarianism. That's breaking news
to probably most of the libertarians on college campuses in this country, and probably around the world. But yeah, the root of this, the criticism that he's making of what he calls libertarianism is that we are too radically individualistic, and that we are not properly concerned with the quote common good. Now, as Peter was saying, like, there's nothing, this is not new for Catholic popes or, you know, the Catholic Church to be in favor of putting the common good ahead of individuals. But he really betrays a pretty shallow understanding of what libertarians actually believe in the remarks as far as we know of them. And so you know, he talked about sort of radical selfishness. He also, the thing that maybe stood out to me most was he essentially implied that all libertarians are moral relativists, that we all believe that we get to decide the difference between good and evil and right and wrong, which
that's up to him. He's the one, though, right? I mean, that's the whole thing about the Pope is he gets... No, I'm kidding. Ish.
Ish. Right. But I mean, clearly there is at least a strong thread in libertarianism and in Reason's variant of libertarianism in particular of objectivism, which has it right there in the name, not big on the relativism. So the idea that, yes, we are all sitting around picking our own good and evils is a weird characterization.
I don't want to say that, like, Martin Luther was a libertarian because that's ridiculous. On the other hand, like... On the other hand, but, I'm gonna go but, no, but he was. No, he wasn't at all. But the tension between the sort of the church and community and the individual relationship with God and with religion, right, was at the heart of Martin Luther's complaints about with the Catholic Church. And so this is sort of a key debate in religious thinking that goes back, you know, at least hundreds of years. The current Pope is, like I said, has sided just a little bit, shaded just a little bit towards the sort of communitarian side of things.
Yeah. And as I point out, I mean, it really sounds like when he talks, first of all, he's sort of famous for being willing to sort of, you know, shoot from the hip, say what's on his mind, whether or not he knows much of anything about a particular topic. In the past, he's talked about the problem with unfettered capitalism.
He's like the millennial Pope.
I was actually going to say he's the Donald Trump Pope, so I don't know. If that shows the two of us are both in a bad place right now.
Yeah, but I really think that's the main criticism I have is like maybe you sit down and talk to some libertarians. I volunteered myself if he'd like to fly me over to Italy. I'd be happy to meet with him and talk about how it is possible that I could be both a church-going Catholic and a libertarian. And I don't think there's any contradiction between those two things. I think actually, you know, my faith informs my desire to support the world system that I believe will actually do the most to alleviate poverty and make everybody richer. That's a motivating factor for me. It's not sort of undermining.
I just had this vision of you in the Vatican wearing your Sex, Drugs, and Robots t-shirt and with like a lace mantilla on your head talking to the Pope about this. I imagine that's not
it's
how
very
it really
fancy
go
and formal,
down.
This vision. No, I mean, this is what always bugs me about like the most extreme anti-libertarian sentiment that, you know, sort of from the communitarian religious community is that there is this total failure of imagination to even sort of conceive of the idea that that capitalism, which is responsible for the sort of greatest increase in the living standards and in the comfort, physical comfort of people in the history of the world, that it's there's this weird idea that somehow it is totally incompatible with things like feeding the poor and caring for the needy, even though it is a system that, however occasionally it has been imperfect, is also, you know, has done the most to do that over in the history, in the entire history of human beings.
Let's talk about something that can help us calm down a little bit, maybe. The first budget agreement of this Congress has
That's not going to help me
happened,
calm down.
Sort of. Yeah, you're right. That was a terrible sell on this since no one feels calm about this. But it actually, it looks a little bit almost like Washington looks sort of sometimes when it works a little, which is to say still not outcomes that promote liberty, limited government, and the policy objectives that we would like to see, but five whole months of a spending bill, you guys. 5 months. That's a big deal, right, Peter?
So the good news here is that there was... even though this was kind of last minute, there was no serious showdown. There was some talk. There were, in the week beforehand.
So when you say kind of last minute, also, I want to note 11:59 on Sunday night.
But the deal was coming together as early as Friday. Like on Friday, there were reports that basically had the outlines of the deal. There was not.
You sound
like a
college student. Like I already had an outline for that paper. So
in my head, yes, I had an outline in my head until that. Right? No, but look. There was no serious showdown. There were some, sort of rumors, sort of reports of possibilities of a shutdown, but it never really got to the point where people thought at during the last couple of days, oh man, we are just not going to make it. The deal it extends for 5 months rather than a week, which was what we were originally looking at, and by originally I mean at the middle end of last week. And it suggests that Congress can do some kind of basic and normal things and keep the government functioning in a basic and normal way. On the other hand, it's also a $1 trillion spending deal that has basically none of the cuts, the discretionary spending cuts that were proposed in the White House budget. And in fact, it funds the National Institute for Health at even higher levels.
$2 billion in new spending for NIH.
I mean, from a process perspective, yes, I guess we should probably give credit where it's due. They managed to come together and like pass something that doesn't meet, you know, that doesn't threaten to shut down the government every week for the next 6 months. But from an outcomes perspective, it's a little less to be desired. Increase in defense spending increases, border security spending increases, or maybe we want to talk about the healthcare subsidies a little later. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot in here to not like from a libertarian perspective.
None of the proposed $18 billion in non-defense spending cuts are part of this agreement. Is that accurate? From what I'm seeing, I think it's true. So anything that we were even moderately excited about in the skinny budget is not there. We do see a $1.5 billion increase in border security, as well as the new money for NIH and a bunch of other stuff.
On the other hand, like these budgets are never, the president's budget in modern history is never
just,
like a real budget.
Right.
It's just like, here is a statement of kind of what I would like things to look like while I'm president, and now go do whatever it is you're gonna do. And usually what happens then is that there's a showdown and then we get more spending anyway. This way we get to like not have the showdown and get to the more spending and then get to maybe doing as well. I don't know if things may not go well from there, but like at least we skip the show. Like the showdowns, I think, are generally unproductive. It's hard to think of a budget showdown in recent years that has resulted in really serious gains for sort of libertarian budgeting. The one exception is sequestration, which has basically been undone, as was predicted, over the last couple of years. They've busted the defense spending caps. And here again, we saw that they couldn't even do a very small cut in defense spending.
So I grew up in the DC area and have sort of fond memories of the Gingrich-driven government shutdowns, which were, I think at the time, still felt like a kind of fresher tactic, and also everyone sort of lost their minds over it in a way that now, you know, even threatening a full-scale government shutdown feels a little bit business as usual. And anyway, the Washington, D.C. metro is on fire, so you can't get to work in the first place. Everyone was going to work at home anyhow. Do you share any of my nostalgia for the full-scale shutdown as an act of political theater?
I don't think I share nostalgia for it. I instead am sort of vaguely, I find it, when thinking back on the Gingrich shutdowns, what I now feel is this sort of amusement that it is now Democrats in the age of Trump using this tactic that they have for decades, not using, I shouldn't say using, because they didn't shut down the government, it right. didn't happen, but it was in part coming from Democrats. That was where the initial rumors that the reports that the government might shut down were coming from, and so seeing that sort of turnabout is again, in some ways, makes me sort of go, oh, head desk, you know, government dysfunction here, right? Like you know, this just sort of like Hatfields and McCoys type situation of everybody using the tactics that were used on them against the opposition, but. On the other hand, it's sort of like, well, that is, it's a little funny.
It's just the latest example, actually, of the reality that neither, especially when it comes to process, neither side seems to actually have any principles at all. You know, as soon as the party in power flips, the party that's threatening to filibuster, nuke the filibuster, you know, shut down the government.
Use executive orders, oppose the use of executive orders.
Changes, and nobody seems to be in any way ashamed of that, which is really unfortunate.
This is something that we actually talked about on the podcast last week as well. The inability of one generation of lawmakers to bind any future generation to any kind of behavior. And that includes both systematically when Congress tries to write rules for itself to create conditions where budgeting will be done in a certain way. Sequestration, again, probably the closest thing to a success on that, but nowhere near. that is so consistently a spectacular failure, and particularly a failure when you do it rhetorically, when you say justice is only served by using this process technique in this way for my party's ends. It seems to create no kind of chilling effect at all to totally flip those messages across the different parties.
But then you get some really delicious moments, like Trump literally in his first day in office reversing a bunch of Obama's executive orders because Obama didn't bother to actually put together a coalition to support them and write them into law. Trump was able to reverse them. So you have some sort of fun outcomes, or even, you know, Republicans are now looking to use the reconciliation process to get their way on healthcare after screaming bloody murder when the Democrats under Obama did that. But it's really hard for the Democrats to say much about it because they are the one, you know, I learned it from you, Dad.
Are you ready for the worst segue in the history of the Reason podcast? Speaking of bloody murder, let's talk about what's going on in the Philippines.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Sorry, everyone. But horrible, bloody murders. This is the Trump of the East, as he was known when he was campaigning, Duterte, who has taken the idea of a drug war to a far more literal level than America has previously contemplated. His regime is getting a lot of coverage right now because Trump seems to be oddly approving of these techniques in a way that is making people nervous. Peter, what is your take on how much what we're seeing in the Philippines mirrors what we could see here in the United States, whether Trump's approval is something we should be reading a lot into or not?
Well, I guess what I think here is that it is a little unfair to call to sort of label Duterte the Trump, a sort of another Trump, since Trump, for all of his flaws, and there are many, many, many flaws, for all of them, he has not sent cop squads around to sort of extrajudicially murder drug dealers all around the country. There's not a wave of kind of quasi-militia dictator violence going on in the United States. There are sort of terrible failed drug war policies that are mistakenly locking up small-time opioid users in Florida, and you should read C.J. Ciamarella and Lauren Cressai's story on that on Reason.com. But, right, there's not, like, cop squads running around with machine guns gunning people down in the streets, which is what's happening in the Philippines. The other thing that's really notable here, though, is that Trump has one of the most consistent things throughout his life, even before he was running for office, is that he has always admired strongmen and dictators. He has always had good things to say about shows of, in many cases, extremely violent force by authoritarian governments. And so this is one of the most worrying kind of habits of mind of Donald Trump, is that he praised the Chinese government for sort of showing strength in Tiananmen Square, that he has gone and praised a number of other authoritarian leaders and dictators, and that this is something that he is now continuing while in the White House, cozying up to one of the most awful kind of violent authoritarian leaders in the world right now.
They had a very friendly conversation, according to a statement issued by the White House on Saturday, and Trump in particular expressed his understanding and appreciation of the challenges facing the Philippine president, especially on the matter of drugs. This is, I agree, of course, with Peter, that what's happening in the Philippines is not anything, there is no analogy to what Donald Trump is doing in the United States, but the broader question of where does the war on drugs end? I think this is the end of the slippery slope. This is the place where libertarians have been saying all along, you know, if you really want to get rid of drugs, you know, both the supply side and the demand side have to be dealt with utterly ruthlessly. And even then, by the way, it's not going to work.
You end up with cartel violence, though, but just run by the state. And that's where the logic of this leads. This is the exact thing that Trump and the sort of hardcore border wall drug warrior types all say, is that, you know, that you've got these cartels running around killing people and murdering people, and it's horrible. And that is exactly what is going on in the Philippines.
It's just that one of the
run by
players
the government.
Is the government. Yeah. And I think, you know, this is a place where, you know, to my mind, when the rhetoric on the border wall shifts to a discussion of drug interdiction, you know, the sort of bright line between our version of the war on drugs and their version of the war on drugs starts to erode a little bit. Slade, what do you think about this story?
Yeah, I completely agree. It's never a bad time to be reminded that anytime, you know, what Duterte is doing is sort of in response to violence and criminal activity carried out within a black market that the government creates, right? And you always get more violence when there's prohibition on something that the people want. When there's a market for something and you force people to go underground, that breeds criminality, it breeds violence, and then it creates a sort of justification for the government to crack down even harder. It's sort of self-fulfilling, or sort of creates their own justification there. And that's a lesson for us that we probably should have already learned, but it doesn't hurt to be reminded of it in real stark terms. The sort of controversy du jour is whether we should be in talks with him at all, or whether he should come to the White House and it's a little hard because as libertarians, I think we tend to not want to be in the business of saying that the U.S. government should be refusing to talk with leaders of foreign governments. But a thing that could be considered you know, maybe a thoughtful decision by one person, when Trump does it, often it comes across very differently. So it doesn't seem like this is necessarily him trying to build bridges in the world and advance America's foreign interests in a thoughtful way. It seems like him just revealing his affinity for strongmen.
There was also a kind of amnesty phase in the Duterte approach to the war on drugs. There was a brief period where he said, if you want to come in for drug treatment, do it now, before the violence starts, essentially. And there have been reports, of course, of people who did interact with the state on that token subsequently being sought after and gunned down. So this is, to my mind, also another example of the... You sound like a crazy libertarian when you say, I don't want to be on the list of people who are doing this disfavored behavior, because what if they come after me later? And again, that's not happening in the United States, but this is a classic example of how it happens in regimes that are less fettered by our own values. Let's talk about the healthcare state of play. Peter, what's going on?
Imagine a cloud.
Oh, God.
Imagine a cloud in the sky.
We're going full metaphor, you guys. Brace yourselves.
Is you look up in the sky and it's there and it takes a shape, and sometimes it takes a different shape and sometimes it's gone. And the cloud is basically sometimes there and sometimes not, but you never know if it'll be there the next day or if it'll be in the same shape or if it'll be there even this afternoon, or maybe the whole sky will be cloudy. You have no idea. That is the state of play for the American Healthcare Act, which is the Republican bill to kind of, sort of, maybe not repeal and replace Obamacare. And it's a cloud, and it's like, it's totally there, and it's also possibly not there at any moment, and you never really know what shape it's in, or whether it's gonna rain on you, or take over the sky, or completely disappear. And currently, the status is that last week, an amendment that had been in the works for about a month was released. This was known as the MacArthur Amendment. It was put out which was negotiated between Representative MacArthur, who was one of the leaders of the Tuesday Group, which is a moderate faction, except... Notably, he wasn't working on behalf of the Tuesday Group, but he was negotiating this with the House Freedom Caucus, who is the sort of more conservative faction in the House, those two groups had kind of provided the locus of opposition to the AHCA. And the Freedom Caucus, in the middle of the week, came out and said, we now endorse the American Healthcare Act as long as the MacArthur Amendment is included. One of the key groups, Heritage, pulled their key vote against the bill at around the same time. You also had a number of other groups that had been opposed to this bill pull their opposition. And so it looked like in the middle of the week, maybe there was some movement, because you had the outside groups at least pulling their opposition, and you had the House Freedom Caucus, which was one of the opposed groups, saying, now we endorse this bill so long as this amendment is included.
There were rumors that a vote was going to happen at the end of the week, then it was going to happen over the weekend, then now the White House is saying maybe as soon as this Wednesday. But we've been hearing these rumors for a month now, and it's really not clear if there's ever going to be a vote. It's possible there could be a vote within 48 hours. There could also be a vote months from now. But the White House has been kind of keeping the rumor fire alive this whole time. And it's really just like not clear if there's enough votes from both the Freedom Caucus, sort of the mainline House GOP, and the Tuesday group, which is the moderate group, to get this bill across the finish line in the House. And even if there are, it's also really unclear whether there's enough interest in this bill from the Senate. You've got folks like Rand Paul running around and saying that this bill is not great in its current form, and that the House Freedom Caucus, all they really did was make it less bad.
And we've got Trump on everybody's television set this morning saying that the GOP healthcare bill guarantees coverage for pre-existing conditions, as if that was like his idea this morning. Can you talk about why is he saying that on TV to me right now, Peter?
So the reason he's saying that on TV is because the MacArthur Amendment, what it does is it allows states to opt out of two major components of Obamacare. It leaves them in place at the federal level. These two components are the essential health benefits. That's the list of stuff that insurers have to cover. It's 10 sort of categories of coverage that have to be included. The other thing that states would be allowed to opt out of are parts of community rating, so long as those states set up what's known as a high-risk pool, which is kind of a government-funded insurance pool just for people who are very, very sick and very expensive. And so long as they set up a high-risk pool or something like it, then they'd be allowed to opt out of the community rating, which is the sort of the key parts of community rating anyway, which is just basically the key to the pre-existing conditions protections built into Obamacare. And so on the one hand, folks who like Obamacare are saying, I think pretty reasonably, that this bill allows states to opt out of the pre-existing conditions rules. On the other hand, it also leaves Obamacare's pre-existing conditions rules in place as the default option at the federal level, and states would have to apply for a waiver and receive permission from the federal government to opt out, and they would have to set up a high-risk pool to cover folks with difficult and expensive medical conditions. However, there's some legitimate criticism of those high-risk pools, which is that they are often underfunded and quite expensive. Trump said in an interview over the weekend that states would not get to choose whether or not to protect pre-existing conditions or not, and that is basically the heart of the MacArthur Amendment. It's a little more complicated than that because states would have to set up a high-risk pool, but high-risk pools have often been underfunded by a lot of arguments. They don't, and they're more, in any case, they tend to be more expensive than traditional individual market insurance. And so, among other things, the upshot of all of this is that it's not clear that Trump knows what is in the GOP healthcare bill or how it works. In fact, I would say that it is a pretty good bet that since he has never attempted to describe it in detail, and when he has been asked questions about it, does not seem to be able to answer them accurately, it seems like a pretty reasonable bet that Trump does not know what is in the healthcare bill.
Let's talk about another component of that list of Affordable Care Act required coverage, which is birth control and associated services. During the campaign, Donald Trump was very clear that that was something that he would be readdressing. But last week, his Justice Department announced that they would continue to, among other things, go after the Little Sisters of the Poor for running afoul of that provision. Slade, what's going on there?
Yeah, so this came as quite a shock, I think, to a lot of sort of conservative Christians, in part because during the campaign, Donald Trump wrote a letter to the Catholic leadership and said, Hillary Clinton wants to force nuns to pay for birth control. That, you know, not on my watch. He explicitly promised that that would not continue on a, you know, during a, under a Trump administration. Fast forward 6 months, and last week, the Justice Department, under Jeff Sessions, you know, a Trump pick, asked the courts for, I think, about another couple of months to basically find a way to win the government's case that was started under Obama. So the government under Obama is in pitched battle against the Little Sisters of the Poor, a group of Catholic nuns who run basically nursing homes for poor, poor elderly people who cannot afford care at the end of their lives.
So basically they're the worst.
Basically they're the worst people ever. Yeah, I mean, how dare they? And they do so by going around the country and begging for money and raising money that would allow them to care for these people who can't afford afford medical care or nursing home care otherwise. Obama said pay for birth control, or at least help us as the government find a way to make sure that your employees get free birth control.
And as a libertarian, just to be clear, you're on their side.
I'm on the side of the Little Sisters because if you're not sort of religious yourself, I happen to be. But as far as I'm concerned, this is a question of economic liberty. You know, it's a question of religious liberty. It's a question of economic liberty. These Catholic nuns are running nursing homes to live out their mission. You know, to serve God and sort of live out the gospel by taking care of poor, needy Americans and people all over the world. And President Obama and his administration said, if you want to be outside, if you want to step outside of your convent, basically, and interact in the world at all, you will do what we say. And that's a problem. I think that should be a problem from a libertarian perspective. So now under Trump, to find out that he's not actually, as he promised, reversing that rule, walking back that rule, dropping those lawsuits against the Catholic nuns and about six other religious nonprofits as well, that's quite troubling.
So here we have a situation in which the libertarian is pro-Catholic nun and the Pope is anti-libertarian.
That about sums it up.
And also the pro-religious liberty president is not.
Right.
But the sort of fun kicker to this is that there have been a bunch of reports over the last week about how thrilled evangelical conservative groups are with President Trump.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing that he has going for him right now, from the perspective of many sort of conservative Christians, I think, is that he did the one thing he promised to do and did is put a conservative on the Supreme Court. So Neil Gorsuch is very popular with many evangelical Christians and just many on the right, and that's like the one big win that Trump can point to say, see, I'm on your side, I've got your back. Meanwhile, he's sort of screwing us over on many other fronts, including going up against Catholics on the southern border who care for immigrants as they're coming across, or as they're sort of you have these undocumented but also unaccompanied children on the southern border who have literally no one to care for them, and the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is there working with them, and Trump is solidly on the other side from the Catholic bishops on that front as well.
Evangelical leader Jerry Falwell Jr. praised President Trump's first 100 days in office. I think evangelicals have found their dream president, he said. Now, of course, we're talking evangelicals, Protestants, not Catholics here. Crucial distinction, but still, I think evangelicals have found their dream president.
I wish I had some explanation for that.
This weekend in D.C. also saw the White House Correspondents' Dinner, in which everyone gets together and pats themselves on the back for doing the work of a free press. Usually they do that in conjunction with the president. This time around, a little bit less warm fuzzies, a little bit fewer warm fuzzies there. The stand-up comedian who performs at these events is always both the most painful and typically the most covered element of the evening. And the takeaway line was essentially, hey, what a country we live in that this, Indian American Muslim can stand up here and make fun of America's president who put a Muslim ban in place. And everyone was like, ooh, burn. White House Correspondents' Dinner, should it be abolished? Peter.
people should be allowed to have dinner, even if they cover the White House, and they should be allowed to do it in the same room.
Okay. Slade?
Yeah, I mean,
I'm for freedom of association.
I don't necessarily think there's anything wrong with the tradition of doing something like this. A free press is important. That was sort of the theme of this event, it seems, especially this year. The theme really was, you know, the free press is important, and let's celebrate the work they do to hold powerful people accountable. That all seems perfectly, you know, right and good from my perspective. The thing that made it a little bit of a cringeworthy spectacle over the last 8 years or so was the, I think that you sort of lost that theme and it became more of a night of glitz and glam and celebrities, you know, rubbing elbows with the president, rubbing elbows with TV anchors, rubbing elbows with the people that are supposed to be then holding the president accountable. And it looked a lot less like a celebration of this important institution in America and more of a sort of something more like the elite or the smoke-filled back room or the sort of oblivious
elite. The Washington
elite.
Cocktail party of conspiracy theory fame.
I mean, the White House Correspondents' Dinner is basically like the molten hot core of White House of Washington cocktail partydom.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it has expanded from like a single night to like a week of parties. Now this year it was down, right? But I think what Slade said is right. It's the clubbiness that was sort of really frustrating, and that's what this reveals is the level of kind of insider schmoozy clubbiness that was that the event took on during the Obama years.
There's also, I think, the sort of hypocrisy of because that the explicit message of the Fourth Estate is important to hold government accountable. That message was still mouthed for all of the 8 years of Obama. There was still a part of the program at the White House Correspondents' Dinner where everyone said like, "Kudos to us for speaking truth to power," and now let's all laugh politely at the president's jokes. And you know, I think. Arguably, that's the way Washington historically has always functioned. It's just that this particular event and that particular dynamic wasn't broadcast on TV in a sort of evening that was of some degree of national interest. But it makes the kind of hashtag resistance, you know, free press stuff ring a little bit hollow now.
Yeah.
And that actually raises the question for me of, you know, if the press is doing now what it should have been doing all along, and I think you can argue that essentially a hostile relationship between the press and the White House is probably the best case scenario.
There should be some tension at minimum.
Right. You know, do we just say like, okay, well, we got it right now and we hope that the hostility continues the next time a Democrat is elected? I think this gets back to what we were saying before about how people are quite cheerful about flipping all of their positions on process and procedure depending on whether their guy or the other guy is in power. And it's still quite clear that the press has a party sympathy, broadly speaking.
This is the filibuster, but for the press.
Yeah, or the activist judiciary, or there are plenty of places where this is easy to flip the card and see the other side. You know, I struggle a little bit with if there's incredibly hostile coverage of say drone strikes under Trump. Yes, kudos, but the motivations for that are all wrong because it was the same drone strikes under Obama, getting. You know, very, very gentle coverage and lots of context and sort of a bland headline rather than the inflammatory one. The New York Times in particular, you know, did essentially a subscription push around, we're going to be mean to Trump, subscribe to our newspaper. Though this weekend, I guess, saw a spate of cancellations of the New York Times because of its coverage of climate.
Because Bret Stephens was hired to as an op-ed page columnist and wrote his first column saying that perhaps we should have somewhat less certainty about climate science and that at least respecting some level of uncertainty would in fact make climate change advocates more effective at their job.
And for that, hordes of people called in to cancel their subscription to the New York Times and presumably their support for the hashtag resistance thereafter.
The New York Times, which we should all note, has one of the largest and most effective climate reporting teams, maybe the largest, in the United States, perhaps in the world.
Let's talk about the Brett Stevens kerfuffle for a minute, because I actually think it's sort of interesting, right? The idea that there's so much power, at least in some subset of the population, still accorded to these people who write 717 words twice a week.
I thought it was like 804 or 806 or something. I thought David Brooks always tries to hit like a weird, slightly over 800 number that is exactly the same for every column.
Maybe they liked David Brooks more than they liked John Tierney when I worked for him, because I'm pretty sure his number was 717. So maybe you've just actually exposed very subtle word count favoritism between the two columnists. Right, so the New York Times op-ed page seems like the kind of institution that should be totally archaic. It seems like it should not be a thing that people get so worked up about in a time when opinion is literally everywhere, and that, you know, the stable of columnists of the New York Times, they're not so different than stuff that you could read at almost any publication. So why is it that Brett Stevens still has the power to drive the news cycle with a fairly bland position for a day and a half?
Unfortunately, I think it's because it's become so normal right now for people to expect. It's almost like the news I read is an expression of me, right? So I read the New York Times because the New York Times is on, you know, sees the world like I do, and it's on my side and is expressing my sort of general, if nothing else, my sort of aesthetic preferences about the world. I don't think it always was that way, but it really, I mean, and I'm not necessarily saying it's a bad thing that we have this profusion of ideological news and reporting, and web, you know, you can go to a website and find the world being reported on from pretty much any perspective you might want, and that's great. That's a good thing. But I think that this is it's become so. What we read or where we get our news has become so tied up in the cable news era with who we are and what it says about ourselves that it's just another way to signal to people, you know, what I care about.
Self-branding through news consumption was not available in an era with three channels, and now it is.
Less so. And I mean, look, the New York Times is at this point sort of self-consciously the house organ for the coastal, educated, kind of elite professional class. And I say that descriptively.
Three of whom are sitting in the room right now.
Sure, right? And I say that descriptively, not critically. And then in addition to that, the op-ed columnists they're kind of like the Supreme Court of op-ed columnists. Like, they basically have tenure there, right?
Should we consider a formal appeals process for op-ed columns in which you can escalate your claims about whether climate denialists should be taken seriously up to the highest in the
and
land?
And they can, like, you know, sort of decide and, like, release whether they're going to consider the matter, and then, like, we all wait around for a year and see who's writing the opinion.
To review, Brett Stevens is the Neil Gorsuch of opinion columnists.
I think that is at least 51% correct.
Fair enough. Before we go, there's lots of good TV happening right now, and much of it people are working hard to draw parallels to our political universe. Are we living in The Handmaid's Tale, Peter?
According to my significant other, Megan McArdle, we are not. I haven't seen the TV show yet, sadly.
This is the TV show on Hulu based on Margaret Atwood's novel, which is a bleakly dystopian sort of conservative, overtoned, sexually repressive future in which we are either marching directly toward it under the supervision of Donald Trump, or actually it's just a book and y'all need to chill out.
I just want to say that everyone should read more Margaret Atwood. That's where I'm going to leave this.
Because of its political overtones, or just because it's good?
Because it's good. And look, the thing that she does, as she is, it would be a grave mistake to call her a non-political writer. But what she does really well is she takes these sort of political situations and she individualizes and personalizes them. And her books are written from in most cases, a fairly extreme kind of individual perspective, right? It's not this sort of global view of a system. You end up getting that global view, right, sort of through the eyes of the protagonist, antagonists or protagonists in many of her books. But she is a great literary writer because she's a great writer of kind of individual interiority, and she captures that so incredibly well that, you know, I mean, like, she's just a really brilliant a prose stylist and story crafter.
On that note, we will sign off. I am Catherine Mengi Ward, editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, and I was joined today by Peter Suderman, features editor at Reason.com. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks for having me. This was fun.
And managing editor of Reason Magazine, Stephanie Slayton.
Thanks.
This is the Reason Podcast. You can subscribe on iTunes and rate and review us there as well. Thanks for listening.